Okay, October 19th, 2008, lecture discussion number 63 on Genesis 1 through 19. So far, or previously, in our oh-so-brief excursion, through Genesis 15, we've dealt with the defilement or the uncleanness from contact with death, for which the remedy was the ashes of the red heifer, a profound portrait of Christ, as you should know. Then Yom Kippur last week, the uncleanness from sin, everything is filthy, priests are filthy, the people are filthy, we're filthy, the altar is filthy, the tabernacles are filthy, everything's filthy. The Day of Atonement. An atonement is required, a special day, this one day, the special clothing that the chief priest must wear, his vestments, his linen garments, the sprinkling of the blood that he does, the cloud of incense that is in, that he must take into the Holy of Holies, the Shekinah glory, which is God himself hovering over the mercy seat, which also must have blood sprinkled on it in order to protect from the law that is inside. And then, of course, the two goats. You can't say this enough. I have a goat for YHVH, God himself, Jehovah, Yahweh. But really, learn to understand that it is not pronounceable. When you say Yahweh, when you say Jehovah, understand that you were saying YHVH. You have anglicized it, or you have made it a general euphemism, if you will. There's a goat for YHVH, and then there is a goat for Azazel, which, as you may have remembered, I will make the case, I think, that the only case that can be made that Azazel is Satan. So there's two goats. One is killed, that is YHVH, or God's goat. The other goat for Satan is let live to run before Satan. So Satan sees that it is alive. One dies, the other lives, and the issue on all of that, of course, if you were here the last couple of weeks, is expiated sin. Understanding what expiated sin is, and understanding that expiated sin is on this goat that runs in front of Satan. So we covered those two things so far with regard to Genesis 15. And Genesis 15, the purpose of Genesis 15 is to answer the great question that Abraham asked God, how can I know I'm saved? And God gives him this three-year-old heifer, three-year-old female goat, three-year-old ram, turtle dove, and a young pigeon after he says, take me, letting you know that those animals are portraying Christ. Note the pattern. Everything portrays Christ here. It's all portrait. How can I know that I'm saved? What God does is give Abraham, gives us all of these portraits of Christ. How simple are they? They're not simple. How can you know you're saved? Well, you have to have a profound depth, in-depth understanding of these portraits of Christ. Otherwise, what? What's the implication? You're going to be thrown about. Knowledge of your salvation comes from studying portraits of Christ in Genesis. So where are we now? We're at the ram. If I'm going to study rams, where am I going to go? I've got to find out what the ram is. I've got to understand how the ram is a portrait of Christ. First, I've got contact with death. Now I have expiated sin. I have this delivery of expiated sin to Satan. Now I'm going to the ram. Where do I go? I'm going to go to Isaac, yeah. I'm going to go to Abraham and Isaac. That sends us to Genesis 22. The sacrifice of Isaac by itself, as most of you are aware, a very complex passage that is what? It's an extraordinary portrait of Christ. And there's your pattern. Portrait of Christ, portrait of Christ, portrait of Christ, portrait of Christ. That's what Genesis 15 is. So always be aware of that as you can. After I'm done with the ram, in Genesis 22, because the ram is there. Abraham is going up the same mountain that Christ goes up when he sacrifices himself. So Abraham is in the exact same place where the crucifixion took place, and he sees what? He sees a ram. And so there's where we begin our study of the ram, is right there. Where do we go after that? Once we've got that ram figured out, where do we go? Of all the rams, by the way, that's probably the easiest ram. You just have to solve why it's caught in the thicket. But after that, I have to go to Exodus 19. What's at Exodus 19? Exodus 19 is where is Mount Sinai, the giving of the two stone tablets to Moses, right? It is the marriage vow of the nation of Israel to God. It is where they say, we will do whatever it is. They say, I do, essentially, and they are the bride or the wife of Jehovah, which is YHVH, right? And what gets blown there? The shofar. It is the first blowing of the shofar. So what is a shofar? It's a ram's horn, specifically the horn of what ram? The ram that was caught in the thicket that is at Genesis 22. So now I have a shofar. It is blown. And it is blown at Exodus 19:6. And that's the first. What's the obvious question? How many horns does the ram have? He's got two. That's right. I blew one. Exodus 19:6, the at least thing I ought to know is where am I going to blow the second one. And by the way, when you read that, you'll see that ram's horn is so loud it made the people just shake and tremble. It was fearful. So once I'm done with Exodus 19:16, sorry, did I say 6? I meant 16. Exodus 19:16, that brings us to Hebrews 12:2. Why does it bring us to Hebrews 12:2? Because I have two shofars. If I have two shofars and I blow one at one time and I blow the other one at the other time, then what have I done? I have begun something and I have finished something. Hebrews 12:2 calls Jesus, looks to Jesus as he gives us two names. One of them is, I've got to spell it, author. Thank you. The other name is finisher. Make sure you capitalize it. That's two names of Christ. He is the author and the finisher, the first shofar and the second shofar. Two names of Christ, author and finisher, that are very important. All names of God are important, but these two are extremely important because it takes us to the four it is. The four it is finishes. That's right. There's four times where Christ says it is done or it is finished. He's a finisher. So he does it four times in a loud voice that the entire world hears. Once on the cross, twice in Revelation, once at creation. So whenever we're talking about him as a finisher, obvious question, what has he finished? Well, he's finished four things. Obvious question, what are those four things? How do they finish? What are they finishing? So after I'm done with the four, it is finished. One of those, by the way, Revelation 21:6, where he says, it is finished. And then he tells you that he is the Aleph and the Tav. What's the Aleph and the Tav? By the way, he doesn't call himself the Alpha and the Omega. He doesn't do that. That is us. That's the Greek. He would use Greek. Of course, he's obviously God. He knows what he's talking about. But this is the Aleph and the Tav. It's the first and the last of the Hebrew alphabet. The beginning and the end. The author and the finisher. Okay? Now, after we're done with all of that, see how easy this ram is? Just figuring out the ram. Take the ram. It's a piece of cake. We'll be done really, really fast. 20 minutes, done with the ram, move on to the birds. Anyone here last time I did the birds? How long did it take to do the birds? 6 months? Yeah. Anyway, after we're done with here, when we get to this point, now we get to the second shofar, where Christ blows it again, or it is blown again. And that is in Revelation 4:1. The first time it is blown at Exodus 19:16, the second time it is blown at Revelation 4:1. Also, 1 Thessalonians 4:16, it is called the blessing of knowing the joyful sound of the second shofar. It is called the awakening blast. 1 Thessalonians 4:16 is famous for being what? As is 4:1 of Revelation. Famous for being what verses? What's in there? What's the context? Rapture. The first shofar is blown when the Ten Commandments are handed out. The second shofar of the ram caught in the thicket in Genesis 22 is blown at the rapture, the catching up of the church. And it is called, blessed is he who understands the blowing of the second shofar. Is this feeding back on me here? So now we're done with the second shofar, and to keep going to understand the ram, all we have to do now is go through the seven trumpet judgments of Revelation chapter 8 through 11. How come I got to do the seven trumpet judgments? Because I'm blowing shofars. And if I'm blowing shofars, I'm in the feast day of trumpets. And what's the difference between a ram's horn and a silver trumpet? Because there is a difference. Don't confuse your ram's horns with your silver trumpets. They're both trumpets, but they're different trumpets. Know your trumpets. Know your different trumpets. Know when they're blasted. Know who they're blasted to, so that you can understand the ram. Okay? And then finally, we conclude the study of the ram, since we're blowing all these trumpets, with what feast day? Trumpets. Got to know the feast day of trumpets. Why do I blow a feast day? What is a feast day of trumpets? Why do I blow the trumpets? Specifically, what happens on that day? Just to give you an idea, you're now studying Jubilees. Have a nice day. How easy is this? Well, I'm going to have to speed it up because I'm going to have to get to the dove and the pigeon so that I can finish all of this as quickly as I can. You'll notice that Leviticus 14 is in your bulletin. That's my doing. Because that's what we call an onslaught of dementia, once again, rearing its ugly head. Because I was so anxious to get to the two birds in my little brain that, of course, I skipped the ram in my little brain. But anyway, the ram's going to take a couple of weeks, but is that enough to cover the ram? No. What you need to know is that it is a very complex portrait of Christ. First, I have contact with death. Now I have expiated sin. What's the ram? What's he doing? How do I know I'm saved? What's God doing? What is Christ doing to Abraham? What's he explaining to him? Whoa. I sound particularly holy.
What are you doing?
I don't know. Where is all the sound coming from? It can't come from my system. I'm still good. Is it this one? No, those are all off. Ooh, is that it? No idea. Okay, maybe it's just... Anyway, once again, it should be obvious that the meaning of the ram can't be achieved in a couple of Sunday morning lectures. So what's that mean to you? I'm gonna tell you the basics, just as I told you the basics here. Contact with death, expiated sin. What is the ram? Right off the top of your head, you should be able to give me what it probably means mostly, even though there's tremendous depth to it. As I just said, you're ending up, what's that? Leviticus 8 being? It is. It's a consecration of the priesthood. Now, that's also in Exodus, but it's, The separating out of the priesthood comes into play here as well. And that's absolutely the case. But I'm gonna go a different direction with the ram. You'll see that today. But you're absolutely right. I have to cover the consecration out of the priesthood. Which, how's that apply to you? Yeah, you are represented by the priesthood. Okay. Do not expect it ever, and it's silly to think otherwise, that the, and by the way, this disclaimer that I'm about to give you is going to be played at your upcoming trial. And that's the one where Jesus is on the throne and he asks you why you didn't study his word. At Proverbs 1:22, he'll quote that to you. He'll quote that to all of us. How long, you simple ones, will you love the simple? For scorners delight in their scorning and fools hate knowledge. Do not expect it ever to be something that is easy to get in a couple of Sunday morning lectures or that it can be gotten from somebody else. How do you get this understanding? Research and study. You devote yourself to it. If you think you could come in here on a Sunday morning and get it from me, you are in big trouble. And Proverbs 1:22 is going to be read to you. And if you try to point to me, good luck. If you say, I came to hear it from Steve, and Steve was going to teach me this, you're in big trouble. Not going to happen. You're on your own. I am not taking the fall for you. I depended on Steve. There he is. Get him. Is not going to work. Loving the simple is not a good thing. Don't kid yourself. Don't think that it is okay to go through your life without understanding this. Because this starts out with what? A question that asks what? How can I know I'm saved? What is that? Doctrinally, that's the assurance of salvation. If you can't not even answer how you can know you're saved, well, how much trouble are you in? You're in a lot of trouble. You have no assurance of salvation, which means at any time you run into any problem, any conflict, your knees are going to buckle, and you're what? Worthless as a witness. And what's your goal? To be a witness. How long will you love the simple? Do not think you could get it from a Sunday morning. Okay, that's your disclaimer. And that just so happens to conveniently transition us to this Sunday's contemporary seeker-sensitive moment. A heretofore weekly segment, and I'm going to do this every week, but it's a weekly segment that I like to call, well, at least it ain't Leviticus. And for those who attended last week, I have written here both of you, you may remember the homework assignment from last week, the vocabulary words. There was a test due today, right? You remember that, I have room to write them on the board, but you were supposed to define permineralized or mineralization. You were supposed to understand the Medusa effect, the instantaneous fossilization that is possible and common. You were to understand mummification. You were to understand the formations of impressions, carbonization, and permineralization, the difference between each of those with regard to a fossil. And how many of you, if I asked you right now to define permineralized or mineralization, could do so? Yay, that's very good. It's very good. How many of you would know all the different types of mummifications? Which one's of particular interest to you because it's 30 degrees outside? Ice, yes, frozen fossils. Fossils that are frozen and have not permineralized. And if they are not permineralized, that means they are what? They are fresh. And if they are fresh, then there's the possibility that they contain heme. And heme, if I ask the nursing students, is a what? It's blood. Okay? I combine it with globin, which is what? It's a protein. And a protein is amino acids in a specific order, right? But if I find traces of heme in a supposedly 77-million-year-old bone, then what do I do with the heme to find out if it's really blood? I take a sample of it and I inject it into a rat. Why do I do that? Because I want to see if I get an autoimmune response. If I get an autoimmune response, then what has happened in the rat? The rat has produced antibodies. If the rat has produced antibodies, then what do I have? I have blood. How can I possibly have blood in a 75-million-year-old fossil? Then something's wrong with my premise, huh? Either it's not blood, or it's not a 75-million-year-old fossil. And that's why all of that's important to you. With all these terms I just gave you, hemoglobin, antibody production, immunological response, immunology, autoimmune, all of that, those are associated with the fossilization process, a process that, in my opinion, each and every Christian should be fluent in. You should be able to openly, cleanly, You should be able to discuss this at the highest possible, every single one of you, there are no exceptions. Do not sit here and say to me that you instead choose to love the simple. Because if you do, you have to deal with that at your trial. And I've got you in trouble now, haven't I? Because I'm on CD. Aren't I, Pat, TJ? I'm on CD, right? And it'll be played at your trial. And you're going to have to say to him why you loved the simple and disregarded something. Why is the fossilization process so important to you? Because it is Genesis, is what it is. We're in a discussion of Genesis. And I cannot, and since I cannot, and I will not ever influence but a very small part of Anchorage, Alaska. I know that. I've known that for 15 years now, at least, that I am a narrowly focused teacher of the Bible, that it is a rare person that comes here. And I'm so sorry for all of you. But I know that. And so being aware of that, I can maybe raise the awareness of those who come to Cliffside, and I can turn you into witnesses for Genesis. For the sake of your children. You know, I deal with your children all the time because they go someplace and they come back to me devastated. Where do they go? They go to the university system. And somebody tells them something that is in conflict with Genesis, and what do? They believe it. And we're going to get into that in just a second. You're going to have to know the four groups. There are four groups that you have to know in order to deal with this discussion of Genesis. And I can't influence very much of Anchorage. I never thought I could, and I certainly have proven that. So I have very small goals. It's my motto. If at first you don't succeed, lower your expectations. So all I'm going to do is deal with that, what I got. If I can get, there's only 40 of you here. That's my typical science class or math class when I taught was 35, 40. Certainly it was a PE class. And if I get everybody in the class to understand what we're fighting over, then good for us. Good for me. That's my goal. Everyone does 30 push-ups and 100 sit-ups before they get their sticker. So this morning, more vocabulary and defining terms for you. My purpose is, I hope, obvious. It's to introduce an extensive foundational level and then start the construction of the hypotheses. And the hypotheses are going to go to obvious conclusions that are scripturally true. How do you decide if something is true? First and foremost, you look and see if the Bible says it's true. If the Bible doesn't clearly say it's true, then what's your problem? It isn't true. So you have to begin to adjust. Now, as you begin to adjust and find out what is true, people will come and attack you for being what? Stupid. They will, trust me. You start standing up, arguing this, and you will be slaughtered. And so you have to be ready to go out there and argue this. My purpose is to introduce, as I said, the concrete, and today is more concrete work. Pretty soon we're going to be building forms for footings and walls and tying steel, and then up will come the structure. So, here we go. It is important to know the whereabouts and the species within those whereabouts of these massive fossil graveyards. How many massive fossil boneyards do I have where there are thousands and thousands and thousands, maybe even millions of fossil bones? How many graveyards do I have in the world? Do you know? There are hundreds and hundreds of them. And you need to know where they are. And you need to know what species there are in there. The Sicilian hippopotamus beds. Thousands of hippopotamuses. Would that be hippopotami? Might be. The great mammal beds of the Rocky Mountains. The dinosaur beds of the Black Hills and the Rockies and the Gobi Deserts. The fish beds of the Scottish Devonian stratum. That's just a few. Like I said, there's hundreds of these. They're filled with fossils. Massive boneyards. The Morrison beds of North America. I hope you're familiar with the Montana beds. The Montana beds are very famous now because we're finding partially permineralized fossils, which means they're not completely fossilized. In fact, it's very common to find a partially fossilized fossil, which to me always seemed to be a contradiction. Why do we call it a fossil if it isn't totally a fossil yet? But as I said last week, we have these huge beds in Alaska, they're in Alberta, they're in the Dakotas, they're in China, they're in Colorado, they're in Utah, they're in Africa, they're all over the place. Millions of dinosaur fossils piled together in great heaps. There's 10 to 30,000 hadrosaurs are found in Egg Mountain alone, and here's my pun, they're scrambled. Okay, I wrote that. But they are. Thank you for laughing. I have 30,000 of one species just mixed all together. Obvious question. How did all these bones get like this? Clearly something extraordinary happened. The greatest vertebrate graveyard is the Karoo. And you need to know about the Karoo. If all you know about is the Karoo graveyard, you will stop 90% of the people who mock you. It's in South Africa. The Karoo is a sandstone shale deposit, and in places it's 20,000 feet thick. And it is filled with fossils. And the fossil beds of the Karoo stretch for hundreds of miles. The fossil count in the Karoo graveyard is in the billions. We have a fossil record in the billions in one bed, one boneyard, one graveyard. I saw an estimate which I'm not sure I can believe, but one, because I found that, by the way, Christians do what to evidence? They try to make it better. They try to inflate it in order to make it what? More exciting. To who? Other Christians generally. What is that? A very bad mistake. God doesn't need your help to manipulate what He has done. But I saw one estimate of the Karoo that said there is 800 billion fossils in it alone. That's what? Had a whole heap, a lot of bones, man. Do they teach you this in school? Why not? Why don't they? A new bone bed has been discovered south of Tampa. See, our choice is to go up to the Lipscomb bone bed on the North Slope, or perhaps we could go to Tampa. Where's Disney World? So our choice is to... For the church, I tried to win the California State Lottery so that we could have church field trips to Tampa, but it didn't work. Sorry. Look, I knew it wouldn't work, but I still tried for your sake. But this one in Tampa is one of the richest fossil deposits ever found in the United States, and they're counting the species so far. Mostly they have found plains animals. 80% of the bones belong to camels, horses, mammoths, bears, wolves, and huge cats. They found one bird so far, the wingspan on that bird, 30 feet. Okay? Now, we haven't seen these kind of mammals. In any event, there's catastrophic death that is unimaginable. These are dead bodies. Imagine if we found a human graveyard that had billions of bodies in it. We have animal graveyards with billions of bodies in it. That is a catastrophic annihilation of life. There was tremendous life on this earth at one time. Unimaginable animal life. What's the obvious question? How did this planet sustain that much life? How do we feed all of those animals? How do we provide water for them? What kind of cosmology or ecological system existed where so much life was here? Okay? And finally, a little theological conflict before we go back to the ram. I do have to figure out how to shorten the, well, at least it ain't Leviticus segment. I'm not so good at that yet. One thing I got to tell you, I may not get back to the ram. Oh, I started late, didn't I? Oh, okay, I feel better. This is, I need you to, you know, I'm going to go from the paleontology to the philosophical here in a minute, but you need to know this. The same skills that you utilize while you're arguing this or while you're navigating the cause of this massive record of death, as well as the origin of this abundance of life and the sustaining of it, the same skills that you're doing, that you're using now to try to ration or reason your way through this, are going to help you on all the other church agendas. If you can do this, you can do this. You can do Genesis 15. It's the same skills. An understanding of the book of Genesis is armor and sword for the doctrinal battles that are going to come to you. By the way, the more you know about bone beds and permineralization and Genesis 15, the more you know what happens to you. What happens to you when you know stuff? God puts you in the fight. And sometimes you come back, it reminds me of the movie of the Black Knight. Sometimes you come back with no arms and legs. But you get in the fight when you know things. But anyway, the understanding of this, it's armor and sword for the battles that come, and especially the doctrinal ones, the control-based, the manipulatively-based methods that infiltrate churches. The reason you fell for those, and we all fell for them, me predominantly, I fell for them. That's why I'm so good at noticing it now. When you fall for all of them and you make a list, and they keep repeating themselves, pretty soon you get really good at recognizing them for what they are. So think of Genesis as predator control, because predators come into the church and you have to be able to understand what they do and how they think and how they fool you. And what do they want from you? They want control of you so that they can get what? They can get your money. That's right. It's always an economic-based agenda. Control becomes economic eventually. So think of Genesis as predator control, or the decon of the Bible. Anyways, four groups you must know, and I won't write them on the board this week, but you need to know literal creation. That's one group. This is four groups that people fall into. You need to know progressive creation. If I ask you to explain to me the discipline or the doctrine of a progressive creationist thought, could you do it? A couple of you maybe. You need to understand theistic evolution, and then, of course, atheistic evolution. Pretty much everyone you come in contact with this debate will fit into one of these four. Let me repeat them. Literal creationism, progressive creationism, theistic evolution, or atheistic evolution. Somebody is going to talk to you in the next couple of weeks, and they're going to fit into one of those categories. If I ask people right now, you'd be surprised who believes what, even in here. Let me explain them. The literal creationist believes that the Genesis record is absolutely pure, literally true, word for word correct. The progressive creationist doesn't believe that at all. Specifically, I'll give you an example. He's not an evolutionist, but he does not believe that there was death after Adam only. He believes that death predates Adam. There is pre-Adam death, a pre-Adamite death, and he even has Adamoids, which are men without souls that perish, that die. The theistic evolutionist says that God used the system of evolution to create the current environment, both pre- and post-flood. So God used evolution as his system of creation, and the atheistic evolutionist, of course, says all of it's a bunch of silliness. There is no God at all, and we are going to cease to exist. So you have cessation of existence versus immortality. The first three say there is immortality. The last one says there is only cessation of existence. Okay? And I have been of particular interest to me, especially lately, but when it came out as well, has been this arrival of progressive creationism. See, I will tell you that progressive creationism and theistic evolution are attempts by Christians to come into the scientific community and be accepted. Do they accept you, by the way? No, they think you're an idiot. They do. They're an atheistic system, and anything that is God designed is of silliness to them. Is it for me? No, too bad. Anyway, I've been fascinated by this arrival of progressive creationism, death before Adam, death outside the garden that's simultaneous with Adam. God as the author of death and the designer of death is what a progressive creationist will say. He will say that death is what, therefore? Good. God decided that he was going to use death. So essentially he has this. He has the garden and he has Adam in the middle of the garden. And surrounding Adam is what? Death. So Adam is in his own little tiny environment here. Not so tiny, garden was huge. But he's in a small portion of the earth, maybe one-tenth of the earth, one-twentieth. And all around him, death. That God purposed, that God designed, God wanted, God put it there. He has a reason for death. That's progressive creationist. If you get on the internet, you will find it everywhere. And I'm fascinated by it because I want to know how you reconcile this with Revelation 21 and 22. What is Revelation 21? It says, there will be no more sorrow, no more crying, no more pain, no more death. Well, wait a minute. If God's designed it from the beginning, why not keep it? Genesis 1:28 says to Adam and Eve to go do what? Fill the earth. Doesn't say fill the garden. Fill the earth. I assume, as a literal creationist, that earth means what? Earth. Just a thought. It's the way I think. Didn't say fill the garden. Fill the earth. Well, wait a minute. How can I fill the earth? I'm surrounded by death out here. So, all of this, by the way, will lead you to understand, or you have a need to understand now, thermodynamics, entropy, decay, transfer of energy. When I put light on something, I'm transferring energy to it. When I eat something, I am taking energy and I am reformulating it. So I need to understand how thermodynamics fits into, or entropy and decay fits into, good. It fits into life without death. And then, of course, that sends me to the totality of the curse, understanding what the curse actually did, the totality of it, and all of that leads me to defense and attack structures. You watch the commercial on TV, Armadillo Man? He's my favorite. When he's scared, he rolls up into a ball and, of course, saves no one but himself, the perfect superhero, Armadillo Man. Armadillos have a defense structure, don't they? If I have no death, why do I need a defense structure? Why do I need armor? Why do I need venom? Why do I need insects that kill other insects? When did insects come into being? Were they part of the original creation or are they a post-curse element? How about bacteria? How about viruses? Is Pandora right? You all know your Greek mythology. Okay. Did is Pandora a representative of Eve who opens up a box and this curse comes out? Is that true? Is that what the Bible teaches? Is that a mythological, a simple evaluation of the scripture? So, add these four things, literal creationism, progressive creationism, theistic evolution, and atheistic evolution. Add those four things to your ever-increasing list of things you must master by when? Next Sunday, that's right. Test on Friday. And by master, I mean significant depth of understanding. Research them. Debate them with each other. But understand one thing about it. If you disagree with the Bible, you are what? You are wrong. So your position has got to be defendable. I don't mind you transitioning yourself through life trying to figure out what your position is. It's real easy. I love what Mike said today. I don't know. That's a whole lot better than being against the Scripture. I don't know. Works good. Do not love the simple. Okay, back to Genesis 15, the ram, which will be caught in the thicket in Genesis 22, and the two horns of the ram. And a lot of people have asked, by the way, is the ram that's caught in Genesis 22 the exact same ram that is beheaded or cut in half in Genesis 15? And if it is, then of course you have a resurrected ram. For those of you who are anticipating the buffet, the pizza has arrived. I just saw it come in. So we're almost done, what I mean by that. So anyway, I got a ram that's caught in a thicket in Genesis 22, and of course those horns on that ram become the two shofars, one blown at Sinai, as I said, and one blown at the Blessed Awakening, Revelation 4:1 or 1 Thessalonians 4:16. Now I ask the obvious questions. I say here to read Genesis 22:10 through 14. Don't have time. I'm assuming you know this. Okay, I'll have to do it. I have to do it. Never come here without your textbook. 22:10. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son, but the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham, that's Christ, by the way. Notice Christ is in heaven and cries to him from heaven. So he said, here I am. And he said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. There's a bunch of questions there because of Ishmael, right? Then Abraham lifted his eyes and looked, and there behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son. And Abraham called the name of the place Jehovah Jireh. The Lord will provide, as it said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. Okay, so there we go. God is teaching Abraham, Christ specifically, the angel of the Lord is teaching Abraham about Christ's coming crucifixion. Isaac is a portrait. The whole thing was a picture. The whole thing was a play, if you will, for Abraham now to learn how it's going to go for Christ. So obvious question number one, why is it necessary to have the ram caught by its horns in a thicket? Is the ram going to run away? Is that what you thought? Ooh, how convenient. It's stuck there. Did you think that? Ooh, bad thinking. Why is the ram caught in a thorn? Why not be tethered by a rope around its neck or its foot? Certainly, what? This is the only way this could be done. The ram has to be caught in the thicket. Okay, has to be caught, has to be worded that way. By its horns. So the correct question is why is this the only way this could be done? Obvious question number two. What's a thicket? What's a thicket? It's a bush. What's on the bush? Thorns. So the ram is caught by the horns in a bush with thorns. How convenient. Many have now noted that the crown of thorns being placed on Christ's head and the ram being caught by the head in the thorns, and they've juxtapositioned both of those side by side, and they said, ha-ha, that's it. They go side by side. The ram being caught in the thickets is a prophecy of Christ having a thorn crown put on his head. You like that? That's okay, I'll give you that, but what's it mean? Christ could have had anything put on his head. He could have had a Hawaiian lei, couldn't he? Why did he pick thorns? Because it's the only thing he could pick. Why? Because it goes back to Genesis 3:18, which is what? Thickets and thorns, the curse, right? So Christ is putting the curse on top of his head. Why didn't he put it around his wrist? Why does he put it on his head? And it's called a what? A crown of thorns. Why does he want a crown? He is the king of thorns. We should not be surprised, by the way, of Galatians 3:13. Christ became a curse for us. Why aren't we surprised that that's in Galatians? Because the commentary that explains Genesis 15 is where in the New Testament? It's in Galatians. So we shouldn't be surprised to find that verse in Galatians. The Abrahamic covenant is a blessing, it says there, meaning that the Abrahamic covenant, Genesis 15 and 12 and parts of 22, is a blessing for the Gentiles. That's us. Obvious question number 3. What's it mean Christ became a curse for us? And I was going to read Galatians 3. I don't have time for that. Jesus Christ intended to be crowned with thorns. He's God. He's in control of his own crucifixion. This is what he wants. He wants to be cursed. He wants to be the king of the cursed. He wants to be king of the curse. And he wants to be king of the law, which is a curse. That's Genesis 3:10 through 14. And it doesn't seem to make sense. And there's a great statement. I need to make that more. It doesn't seem to make sense. What's the implication? It does make sense. It just doesn't seem to us to make sense, which means what? Well, we're doing. It doesn't seem to make sense that the ram is caught, because the ram is who? It's Christ. Christ is caught in the thorns. Christ is who? Omnipotent God. Can you catch Christ? No. So how is it that the ram is caught? How do you catch... Obvious question number 4. How does omnipotent God become caught? Can omnipotent God be caught? By God, yes, good answer. God must what? Catch himself. Jehovah Jireh. Jehovah Jireh Salam. Jerusalem. God must catch himself. God must provide himself. It's the same thing. Who's really caught in the thorns? We are, absolutely. We're caught in the thorns. How do we get out of the thorns? See, that's a very important understanding of the ram now. How do you get out of the thorns? Well, that's very close, believing God, but God has to get you out of the thorns, doesn't he? How does he get you out? Does he come in there with shears and cut you out? How do you, what's the process? You're stuck in the thorns, all of you. You're the ones that are caught in the thorns. He's not caught in the thorns. He's come to get you out. And to get you out requires what? It's Br'er Rabbit, isn't it? He has to go in order for you to come out. It is a redemption. For everyone that comes out, he has to go in. It's an exchange. There's a price. It costs. A price must be paid. What's that price? A substitute must take our place in the thorns. Okay? Christ must take our place. We are free. Musicians, run quickly before the pizza gets cold. We're stuck in the thorns. He's got to get us out. So what do we know about the ram so far? The ram is about thorns and substitution, about a price paid. So far, so good. That's why he put the crown of thorns on. It's what he's doing. He's saying, I'm that ram that's caught in the thorns, and I have to substitute to get you out.
I am king of the thorns. It's absolutely what he's saying. If he's king of the thorns, that's good news, right? We got to get out of them things. How easy is it to get out of the thorn? It's impossible unless somebody gets us. What does he use as grease? He's got to get, you're stuck. I can't even imagine. Think impaled in thorns. Not movable. He's got to get you out. How's he do it? He has special lubricant. Suck you right out of there. What is it? It's his blood. Let's rise and be dismissed.